What is Catholic apologetics and why is it important? What does it mean to be a Catholic apologist? Why do some Catholics think apologetics might be a little dangerous for our faith? We're going to discuss these issues on today's Crisis Point. Hello, I'm Eric Sammons, your host and the editor-in-chief of Crisis Magazine. Before I get started, I just want to encourage people to like and subscribe to the podcast. It just lets other people know about it and find out about it. And you can find out when our new episode's coming up. We have a lot of great guests, including today's, coming up in the next couple months. So you want to be able to find out about that. Also follow us on all the different social media channels. I say I'm in most of the podcasts, but you can find us. Okay, so let's get started. Our guest today is Trent Horn. And Trent Horn earned his master's degree in the fields of theology, philosophy, and bioethics. He serves as a staff apologist for Catholic Answers. Trent is a frequent guest on the radio program Catholic Answers Live, and he hosts his own podcast, The Council of Trent. He's also been invited to debate at UC Berkeley, UC Santa Barbara, and Stanford University. He's an adjunct professor of apologetics at Holy Apostles College and has written for the National Bioethics Quarterly, National Catholic Bioethics Quarterly, and is the author of 9 books, including Answering Atheism, The Case for Catholicism, and Why We're Catholic, Our Reasons for Faith, Hope, and Love. And I would just add, I think Trent is probably one of the top Catholic apologists today, in my opinion. So welcome to the program, Trent.
Thank you for having me, Eric, and thank you. That's very kind.
Yeah, we want to talk about apologetics here. We're going to talk in generically, but I also want to talk about your personal experience. Let's first talk about why did you get interested in apologetics in the first place?
Well, I think that there's a stereotype, and there's a nugget of truth to it. That's what always drives, a lot of stereotypes, that being a convert, people always think, all the apologists are converts, basically. And that's not actually true. Like Pat Madrid is not a convert, for example. But during my conversion experience in high school, I had to go through the objections for myself. So in doing that, I have to find the answers and tabulate them and go at them head on. And in doing that, I after I was done with that process, I did youth ministry and then other ministry after that. I wanted to help people to get those answers in a more efficient way than I had. And that's true, I think, for many other people. I think Jimmy Akin probably has a similar experience, or Tim Staples. When you are for certain kinds of converts, you have to go through all the arguments. And since you want to help other people do the same.
Right. Okay. Now, let's talk about just generically then apologetics and the role of apologetics in the Catholic faith and how it relates to Catholic evangelization. I mean, I wrote a book, The Old Evangelization for Catholic Answers.
Yeah.
So I have some understanding this, but I think it'd be good to explain like the relationship between the two,
right?
When we engage in evangelization, apologetics, and how they're related.
Yeah. So I would say that apologetics is a tool at the service of evangelism. And I think it's very important for people to distinguish between the two. Some people treat apologetics and evangelism as if they were the same thing, and they're not the same thing. Evangelism is just sharing the good news about salvation in Jesus Christ. So that's what it is, that when you evangelize, you share the good news about Jesus's, that he is God incarnate, he died for us on the cross, and that by placing our faith in him and entering into the new covenant through the church he established, we can have eternal life. So that's the good news. That's evangelism. Apologetics comes into the fray when apologetics would be defined as providing a rational defense of the Christian faith. Well, generically, apologetics is giving a defense of any kind. Like people will say you're an apologist for X or Y. It comes from a Greek word apologia, to give a defense. Like Socrates gave an apology in Greece at his trial. It's a defense. Though when we talk about it in Christianity, we mean that it is a field of theology dedicated to the rational defense of the Christian faith. So it plays in that evangelism is sharing the good news. Apologetics is a tool that we would use when people might say, well, I don't think the good news is true, or I think there's no good reason to think it's true, or there's reasons to think it's false. And we would deploy an apologetic of some kind to answer that, to clear out the obstacles so that you can evangelize.
Often I would think evangelization often is talking about your personal story, about your relationship with Christ, how Christ has affected your life and things like that. But then other people who haven't had that experience might be like, yeah, but I think Jesus was just a man or something like that. And that's
right.
When you would then segue right into an apologetic.
experience.
Right. So it's important. And I think that personal testimonies can be valuable to many people to be able to share. Here's what Christ has done in my life. This is my faith journey. People really resonate with that. I mean, I think probably one of the most popular books that has evangelized people to become Catholic is Pat Madrid's first anthology, Surprised by Truth. I know that that affected a ton of people in the late 90s, early 2000s. I read it during my conversion experience, just reading stories from other people. But what was neat about that anthology is it included stories of, hey, here's what Christ has done to me. This is my conversion. But also, here are the objections that I dealt with, and here are the answers that satisfied me. So I think that we can put forward a good evangelism that is testimonially based, that is authentic, but also uses apologetics in a way that is not ham-fisted or triumphalist or the flaws. And there are flaws in apologetics, just like there's flaws in any discipline within the church that we have to watch out for. We can do it in a good way.
Right. For me, it was Scott Hahn's conversion story, of course, was a big one for me, because he does incorporate apologetics in it, because he obviously is talking about how he overcame his objection to Catholicism. But to me, it was more just the idea that a Protestant pastor could become Catholic was like, that alone was enough to be like, oh, and he was just telling his story. Now, apologetics, of course, has been practiced since the time of Christ. I assume the Jews probably practiced it even before that, but it's been practiced by Christians since the time of Christ. But in the 1970s, particularly, it got a bad name. And I feel like my understanding of the history, having lived through some of it myself, is that Carl Keating, at least in this country, kind of single-handedly brought it back from the dead. And I mean, I know some others did, but I mean, he really was instrumental.
Well, I want to, you know, I'm going to grab here. I'm going to disappear out of the frame. Hold on. I'm not leaving. It's on the floor. I got to grab this. It's not just him. I have this little book here. Catholic Apologetics Today, Answers to Modern Critics by Father William Most.
So, right. Yes, that was a big one as well. Absolutely. I remember reading Catholicism Fundamentalism. That was a big one for me. But really, you know, Catholic Answers, Carl Keating, Father Most, they kind of brought it back. But it was dead. And it was kind of dead.
It was on life. It was on life support, for sure.
Life support is probably that's a better way to put it. But people really thought that it was wrong to do this. And I've started to see some of that coming back, that people, in fact, I saw an article recently where they're kind of attacking kind of conservative and traditional Catholics, and they're saying it's based on this idea that you have answers to questions or something like that. Why do you think, why is apologetics denigrated in some quarters of the church?
That's a hard one, because what's interesting here, when we think of apologetics, it's had a rich history. A great book to read on this is Cardinal Avery Dulles's History of Apologetics. Goes at it from really the second century onward. You see against pagans, counter-reformation through modernism, against the Anglican controversies in the 19th century, Newman. And then in the early 20th century, you have people like Frank Sheed, you know, doing the Catholic Evidence Guild. He was doing Catholic Answers back in the 30s, essentially. But then after the Second Vatican Council, I think there was a concern that it was conflicting with the goal of ecumenism, the goal of seeking out building bridges with other religions, other Christian denominations, other religions, and that if practiced in a triumphal way or in a closed-minded way, it harms that ecumenical movement. And here I want to be fair to both sides. There are brands of apologetics that can be harmful to ecumenism, like apologetics that will seek to refute, let's say, Islam or Mormonism or other religions, and it doesn't understand the very religion it's trying to refute. So if I go to a Muslim and say, well, here's the problem with Mohammedanism, you a Mohammedan, they would say, I'm not a Mohammedan. I am a Muslim. I don't worship Muhammad. I've already gotten off on the wrong foot, essentially. I've misunderstood. So they're not going to hear what I have to say. And so that can be harmful. But a good apologetic is essential, because the goal of ecumenism is to, you know, we're separated from people who disagree with us. We want to close the gap as much as possible, but then we don't want to stop and just sing kumbaya. We want to close the gap so that jumping the gap to bring people to Christ is more manageable. And I think that's the goal to see. And it's hard when people will try to pit the two against each other. No, like if we do ecumenism, say with the Orthodox, we can say, hey, there's actually a lot we can learn from you guys on different issues. So we get closer and closer and closer when the gap is smaller. It's easier to do apologetics when the gap is small versus when the gap is wide. So you're right, but I think that the people in the 70s onwards kind of had this feeling that it's either antithetical or it's not the laity's job. That's what priests do. That's what theologians do. That it's really, that's more of a Protestant thing, not a Catholic thing. And yeah, I think Carl, Patrick Madrid, Tim Staples, Jimmy and others really revitalized this as a lay notion. But I've seen this online, certain social media circles. And it's I always ask people, they'll say things like apologetics is dead, or oh, the last thing the church needs are apologists. And I ask them, well, what do you mean by that? Like, I agree with you. It doesn't need bad apologists, just like it doesn't need bad liturgists. It doesn't need bad evangelists. It doesn't need bad bishops. It doesn't need bad people who do corporal works of mercy in a bad way. You could do that in a bad way, too. It doesn't mean it's wrong to do these things. It means we should do them the right way.
Yeah, and I also think that, wouldn't you say that in the modern mind, there's this idea that we can't have answers, that we can't have definitive answers. And I've seen that's another criticism of apologists. They think they know everything, or they think they have a final answer on thing. How would you respond to somebody say, well, why do you think you have the right answer on this?
Right. So a few points jump out at me. First, this position, if you take it too literally, is self-refuting. You can't have any answers, but I know apologists don't have answers. Now, that's just a quick observation. To be fair to the position, and that's something that I'm trying to encourage in others when I do apologetics, when I do debates, when I do dialogues, to be fair to the other side. Like, and being charitable isn't just about not calling other people names. Being charitable also means correctly understanding your opponent's position and representing it well before showing what's wrong with it, which is what Aquinas does in the Summa, for example. Sorry. So I think that when you see these criticisms, there is some truth to some of them when apologetics is done badly. So when you have apologists say, oh, well, here's the obvious solution to this problem, or here on this issue, this is the right answer. An apologist can get in trouble if he fails to acknowledge, oh, well, there is another solution that could be offered. The apologist who says, oh, that there's only one way to resolve this particular open theological question in the church. Like, let's say they only advocate for a very strict kind of Thomism with predestination, and they don't even say there is all other things like Molinism and what Duns Scotus says. If you act like, oh, I've solved it, I've got this rigid set of answers, and you overplay your hand, that's problematic. That you should be confident in those things which are definitive, and you can talk about the variety of options with questions that are more open. But I do think that the critics who say this, to be honest with you, Eric, I think a lot of them, they have bought into a modern heresy affecting the church, and that would be a kind of universalism. Idea that, look, everybody's basically going to heaven. We don't really need to convert people. So apologists, the only thing they'll do is they'll come off snotty or arrogant and drive people away. That we should just focus on works of mercy and the liturgy, and that will draw people in, and the arrogant apologist will push people away. Yeah, we don't need the arrogant apologist, but some people need the answers. They might say, hey, this is beautiful, but I don't think it's true.
Right. Now, we were talking about the tension between ecumenism and apologetics. Now, I my most recent book is pretty critical of how ecumenism is done and has been done for quite some time, because I tend to believe that it ends up being people who just want to talk about how great the other religion is and just then go to their cocktail party and that's it. There's no real sense of, okay, here's where we think you're wrong.
Right.
And you can tell us where you think we're wrong, but we want you to know where we think you're wrong.
Or if we say we think that you're wrong, and the other side may say, well, actually, we agree with what you say. We're just using different wording. Like, right. We look at the efforts that have come in discussions, Catholics and Orthodox discussions, or the joint declaration on justification between Catholics and Lutherans. Once again, about bridging the gap, but still recognizing, well, here is something that we have not resolved yet, and to offer the other side, here's the problem. So I agree with you, Eric, that I think that when ecumenism is sort of done by like these, advisory bodies. And you're right that it's just about meeting in a fancy hotel. And we had a nice banquet hall and a PowerPoint. And that when it's done in that way, when it's not done with a serious attitude of here's where we agree, here's where we disagree, here's our arguments we would like you to wrestle with. That's what. But however, I think ecumenism, it can be done in a good way. Like, I think I try to model that myself on my podcast, that I will do debates or I will do informal dialogues with people that are nice to chat with, you know, and I've had these with a wide variety of people. That is where you can have that authentic ecumenism. Say, here's where we disagree. Here's where I'm not sold. Or, hey, here's an argument I really need you to wrestle with. But I think we're going to see that more in the personal interactions or among scholars who really take it seriously.
Right. And that was kind of my experience, because I really got exposed to Catholicism through the pro-life movement. And that was an ecumenical effort. And we would get together, and a lot of times we'd come together and we'd agree with stuff, the Catholics and the Protestants. But then we'd also one-on-one at the abortion mills or afterwards, like that, when we go out for coffee after we were praying at the abortion mill, we would then have our debates about, okay, well, here's why I think you're wrong, and here's why
that's
I think
right.
You're right, stuff like that. And it was beautiful. I mean, it was a way that we were working together.
And so the other side is correct. They'll say, well, you don't need apologetics. You just need to build a friendship and a relationship with people to draw them to Christ. And I would say, you're correct. We should do that. That's one of the most effective kinds of evangelism, are these relationships of mutual respect and friendship when we have things in common. I would say that in many cases, it is necessary. In some cases, that will be sufficient to move someone to want to consider Catholicism. But in other cases, it won't. That's why, I mean, it's like saying, you know, I don't need a flathead screwdriver. Why would I need that? I can always use my regular screwdriver or other things to get my job done. You're like, well, you might have been able to from any of these jobs. You may come across a job where, oh, actually, I do need this. If I don't have this, I can't get this screw out. And you'll be glad you had the tool when you needed it, even if there were many cases where you had the tool and you did not need it. And I think that's true of apologetics.
Right. Now, when engaging in apologetics that's a very broad term. Obviously, sure. We're Catholic, and you engage with apologetics with anybody who's not Catholic. How do you distinguish, like, between apologetics with atheists, Jews, Muslims, Protestants, Orthodox, and because you do it with everybody, it seems like. And how do you really go about distinguishing between how you approach those different groups?
Right. So what I would try to do is understand where the person is coming from, and honestly assess, you know, the gap that I have with them, and see what is the fundamental issue that we're disagreeing about, and not get sidetracked on other issues. So with atheists, I'm going to focus on the evidence for and against the existence of God. I'm also going to understand that amongst these groups, some people are closer than others. So I have more common ground. So, for example, it's not proper to speak of evangelizing the Eastern Orthodox. What we speak of is unification with the Orthodox, to say that the title of church can be applied to your churches because you have valid holy orders and apostolic succession. And so we can recognize that. When it's with Protestant ecclesial communities, then I would say, well, we have a firm foundation in the Trinity and a valid baptism. So affirming the similarities we have, but I mean, it could be, you might say, well, what do you do like an atheist? You got no similarities. Not necessarily. I had a wonderful conversation with an atheistic apologist recently, but he has been very critical of atheistic tribalism. Like, other atheists have criticized him because he's very pro Second Amendment, for example. And we had a good chat about how, you know, you can take the atheist out of religion, but you can't take the religion out of the atheist. You still want to create your codes of behavior, your groupthink. And so even there, we found a common ground. Now, it was cultural and social common ground, but sometimes that can be helpful. That builds a bridge and caring about evidence and logic. So that's when I'm engaging people, I just want to see what brings us closer together, and then try to really understand their position, and being very careful to not place them in a monolith. So that example of, you know, the atheist I spoke to, he's not like your social justice raving liberal lunatic online. He's unique. And the same is true when you look at other apologists or other people you might engage. Just as, like, if you say, oh, if someone says, oh, I spoke to someone, they're Catholic. You and I both know that word is so elastic.
Right.
Like they're Catholic. Oh, that could mean that. I mean, there's a big difference between Father James Martin and Father Ripperger, you know? Yeah. so that's why, but we Catholics, we can be guilty of that too. If we say, oh, well, he's Protestant. Well, there's a big difference between Protestants, even Muslims or Jews. So that's why it's important when we engage others to get past the label and really understand what is their particular view globally, like which religion are they, but also where do they fall within that particular religion or lack of religion.
Right. So you're trying to figure out where they stand, what you have in common with them. It's funny you mentioned that because I know a number of Orthodox, and I know, like, I have a friend who's an Orthodox priest who basically thinks all Catholic sacraments are invalid and that we're all basically out of graceless and out of the church and all that, and out of the true church. And I know other Orthodox priests who are very much more accepting of Catholicism and understanding that we have valid orders, things like that. So you have to kind of know who it is you're talking to. And so now let's talk a little bit more about specifics of today. Sure. One of the great challenges I know a lot of people have, Catholics have, when they're trying to engage in apologetics with maybe even non-Catholics or people is the scandals within the church today specifically. Now, the moral challenges, the moral problems of leaders, that's one thing. But I mean, like, today, where we have a pope who, I'll be diplomatic and say, he says some problematic things. And so when we're trying to say, like, here's an example I had where a woman wanted to, when I was working for a diocese, she wanted to set up a group that was supportive of homosexuals. Her son had come out as gay. And, mm-hmm. and basically she wanted a group that was going to be basically endorsing homosexual behavior. And I said, no, that's against church teaching, whatever. This was in 2013, 12 or something like that. Well, then Pope Francis came. He said the famous words, who am I to judge, and some other things. Things like that. And then she basically then was like, well, the Pope says it's okay. Now, I know he didn't actually say that, but the point is that he's winked and nudged at times. And so it makes it where I'm going, they're comparing, they're just saying, okay, the Pope says this, but you say this. Well, who are they going to go with? And I don't blame them for saying, I'm going to go with the Pope. But what do we do in those situations where we do seem to be going against what the Pope seems to at least be indicating, if not explicitly saying?
Well, I think there's multiple strategies one can employ. And you might use them in different order. I mean, the basic line here is if you're engaging someone, you have to make sure if they're saying that the church teaches X when it actually doesn't teach X, you'll need a primer on understanding, well, how do we know what the church teaches? My friend Jimmy Akin has a wonderful book on this subject called Teaching with Authority that goes over that magisterial statements from bishops or the Pope have different levels of authority. So at one point, you'll need catechesis with an individual to say, look, different statements that the Pope makes have different levels of authority. There's a difference between, something that dogmatically defines something like the Immaculate Conception versus an impromptu answer on an airplane to let people know, look, certainly you would agree with the Pope says has different levels of authority. And that also is in union with what the church teaches. Because you say, well, look, the Pope doesn't contradict the church, right? No, you know, so then you go to the catechism, paragraph 20 through 57 on homosexuality. But you can also, before this, maybe show the person, you have to be careful not to act like you're trying to really grill the person, but you might want to show that they're being a little self-serving sometimes to say, you know what, you're right, we got to listen to Pope Francis. So, like, you know, when Pope Francis said abortion is like hiring a hitman, you would agree that abortion's just like that, right? And so, because that's the thing with Pope Francis, he's the gift that keeps on giving, you know, and so it's funny, you watch the roller coaster online of, people like, Advocate Magazine, a pro LGBT magazine, others like Pope Francis is man of the year for them. And then the CDF, under his permission, releases a document that prohibits blessing same-sex unions, for example. Which includes that it's released under his permission, and they're having to backpedal like, oh, well, or, you know, and he'll say one thing, you're right. And then it's a roller coaster for everybody. Right. So I think there, if you're shrewd, if someone is taking something the Pope has said to try to promote a dissenting view of church teaching, sometimes it's fun to see, well, what do you do with this very heavy-handed Orthodox thing the Pope has said? Will you go with that too? Or are you just cherry picking when the Pope you know, says problematic things that happen to favor what you think. So that has to be done with due caution. You want to be gracious with people, but I think that can be helpful to show, look, are you cherry picking? Are you listening to the whole of magisterial teaching?
Right. And related to this, now this one, a little bit more tricky. There are situations in which as Catholics, we simply just don't agree with the Pope and what he said. We think something he said is wrong. And I'm talking, of course, not about doctrinal issues like the Trinity or something like that, but maybe in him pushing for the vaccine or
like a prudential judgment.
Yeah. But even, I mean, even when he, like the death penalty,
sure,
probably is the best example in my mind,
right,
where it really, to me, I mean, I've said this before, it really, to me, sounds like he's just simply contradicting church teaching on this, because the death mm-hmm. penalty is clearly
right.
justifiable, you know, in certain circumstances. And I understand, like, you know, Pope John Paul II was making it more like it's not really necessary in developed world, all that. But then sure. we get, because I know one of the criticisms the Catholic Answers has gotten is that sometimes sure. it's a little too willing to try to defend the Pope on some of the more problematic things it says. And is there a role in, I mean, how does it under, I'm not even sure what my question here is at this point, but like, I just know a lot of Catholics have challenges when they're talking to their friends who are either fallen away Catholics or not Catholics, trying, they don't want a Pope's blame, but yet they, right. they also want to be respectful of the papacy. How do we do both those things?
Well, it is a fine line to walk between two errors. And it's something that I have learned over the course of Francis's pontificate to walk, and I've tried to grow in that area, at least in the past few years, of addressing these things. Because you're right, because prudential matters are one thing, and I'll discuss that a little bit after this. But this is more the question. Well, it's interesting, as an apologist, people will bring up objections to the faith, and one common objection from Protestants is, the actions of this particular pope actually show Catholicism is false. You know, the common examples were Pope Liberius, Honorius, Vigilius, you know, from the early Middle Ages, things like that. And so you'll go through. And so I think your question seems to be concerned. What about people who add Francis to this armada, essentially? What should we do if we agree with them? How do we respond? And you're right. So there's the two errors. One would be a kind of ultramontanism that basically it's as if the Pope, as every utterance, is infallible and will bend over backwards to defend him and not ever just say, yeah, he just really biffed it on this one, you know. But then there's another view that goes a bit too far that would almost seem to deny the Holy Spirit's promise that it will you know, prevent the church from habitually falling into these errors, or you it's almost maybe tabloid-esque a little bit so much that you sound like those fundamentalist Protestants from the 80s. Like, I've heard some online Catholics talk about the Pope. I'm like, who is this, Jack Chick? Like, I've thought about it'd be a fun game, like, you know, very angry traditionalist anonymous Twitter Catholic and Jack Chick, you know, the famous very anti-Catholic cartoonist, putting their quotes together, I'd be like, oh, wow, these almost look identical. So you don't want to fall into either of those traps. So I think my response to that would be, and I think this is something hopefully the Catholic Answers has grown in, I've tried to grow in. And actually, it's interesting. Something like this did come up in my rebuttal to a Eastern Orthodox apologist named Jay Dyer. And right. So Jay brought up, you know, look at what Francis has done with the death penalty. And what was funny is he sounded a lot like Taylor Marshall with his criticism. But then the conclusion is, therefore, become Orthodox. And so my reply there, and I think this is important, is, like I said earlier, we should offer a lot of different options for people. I follow Jimmy in this regard, and I think he's very good at this, to say, well, here's a difficulty, and there's a few different ways a person might address the difficulty. And just allow, it's, you know, that, and just allow, hey, there are certain things we can't say. You know, we can't say the Pope can formally bind the church to heresy or something like that. But we could offer a lot of different options. So one could offer the option that what the Pope has taught, that this falls under a prudential judgment that does not require the religious submission of mind and will. And, you know, to say that this is erroneous, but it does not fall under an error that is covered under papal infallibility. So you could say that's one option. Another option that could be presented is that this is a development in Catholic social teaching, and give examples about how different social teachings can develop. Like one might say with the death penalty, the church always considered it moral to exercise the death penalty for a wide variety of crimes, even, public theft, hunting on the Lord's land, and a wide variety of crimes were seen. It was permissible to use a penalty of death to instill public order. But over time, the crimes that are suitable for death, it shrinks and gets more and more narrow till it's just like murder or treason. And the idea here is maybe you see there's a trajectory in development that the justifications keep getting narrower and narrower over time. So that, as I said, those are two options. So I think that's helpful that look, we're a big tent. People are going to have different views about which prudential judgments or even theological observations that are made or opinions of prelates or the Pope are, you know, their value of them. But I think that could be helpful when these things come up to put forward all the options. You can almost put it as like, here's my preferred one. And if that argument doesn't work, here's my fallback position. And all of them, it's like I have all these safety nets, if you will, that catch me before I fall into schism or leave the faith or something. I don't know. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think so. I think the challenge is, I mean, some of it's interesting because I feel like some of the more ultramontanists, at least, they're saying exactly what I was told as a Protestant by Catholic apologists. No, we don't do that. We don't think everything the Pope says is infallible and things like that. We don't treat him as a divine oracle. I think the people I've talked to about this when it comes to Pope Francis, we're willing to understand that there's tons of things he says that are just problematic, but they're just like, you know, it's an airplane interview. He has certain politics that we don't agree with, which is fine, you know, whatever. But it's when he hits on, I think the big ones are probably the death penalty, the communion for divorced and remarried, where it's like, it looks like he is changing a church teaching that can't be changed. And the whole structure of Catholicism does really depend on that. And I think I know people, and I'm sure you do too, who have left the church or following because of this, because they feel like, okay, the foundation is crumbling because we said the Pope cannot change unchangeable church teaching. And yet it, at least to them, it appears he has. So, and I know we had, I know we've had the debate. You've been involved with it about change, what it means to change church teaching.
Right.
Sure. And we've both written about that. And I think we come at it from different perspectives, but I think that's really a issue of apologetics that I think is causing a lot of issues, which some of that, I try to look at more optimistically, is it helps refine our apologetics.
Right.
These things happen. But how would you like say those, how does it not make the foundation crumble? How would you answer those who, I mean, I don't think it does, but I know people who do.
Right. And I think that that's where it will become problematic that as an apologist, if you put forward an extremely strong, indefensible claim about something that this never happens or the church never does this or, you know, things don't change. How you articulate it, you have to be careful so that you're not left open to a counterexample, whether it's in the current age or in the past 2,000 years. When you look at things like how church fathers have articulated matters in the past versus the development in modern science and things like that, because you could go too far and say, well, look, if the fathers are in agreement on something, then you're bound to believe that. And but the problem is, well, no, you have to tailor the understanding of what that in particular means, because then you might bind people to believe an outdated scientific theory. I'm sure the fathers of the church all believe in the theory of the humors, you know, that our health system is basically four fluids going together. We're not bound to believe that, but that would also apply to scientific observations about the age of the earth or the development of life that could lead you into problematic areas if you're in conflict with other things. So I think that you're right. Like the concerns that are brought up, that you just have to make sure that that what you're putting forward, that you use this as an opportunity to refine the position you put forward. And I think then in charity is to offer people, it's kind of like, you know, they're looking at Catholicism. They might say, you know, because it's interesting, like when I'm engaging people who are Eastern Orthodox, many of them will say, well, I can't be a Catholic because I think Thomism is bonkers. I think that Thomas Aquinas is, he doesn't make sense. He's crazy. It goes against everything the Cappadocian fathers taught, you know.
Right.
And so I would say, well, okay. So there's two options here. You could defend Thomism, which I think is a fine thing to do. Or you might say, hey, you know what? If you find this problematic, there are other ways to articulate these theological issues that you might find to be more like a Franciscan way or other things like that. So just like if I offer, you know, let's say Pope Francis and the death penalty, I'd say, here's my preferred solution. Someone might say, that sounds like you're grasping at straws. I can't really buy that. All right. Here's what Eric Sammons would say. And, you know, and he's faithful to magisterium and he's Catholic. You might prefer that. So I think when we're engaging others, we should be open to presenting people a variety of orthodox proposals, even if we're not a big fan of them, as long as they're orthodox and have not contradicted, you know, the positive faith, then that can serve the cause.
Right.
And sometimes what I do, I just say, I don't know how to reconcile it.
Yes, that's another approach.
I mean, because the fact is, I do know it's not, I don't think it, there's so much evidence for Catholicism in every other way. The fact that in this one area, I'm not able to reconcile it with my brain doesn't make me lose my faith in the fact that everything else. It just means that, okay, my puny brain can't reconcile right. that.
Well, there's a parallel here that if you say, well, the Pope said this, but the Catechism says that, this seems contradictory, therefore Catholicism is false. If you walk in that mindset of, hey, there is an apparent contradiction in my faith, therefore the faith is not true, you're only going to get about 10 steps. What do you do when you read when you read the Bible and you've got atheists who have assembled 1,001 Bible contradictions? You know, Mark 2:26, it says that Jesus said when Abiathar was high priest, when the Old Testament clearly says it was his father Ahimelech. But then what do I do in those situations? You could say, first, if you've never studied it, I don't know, that's weird. But I know Jesus walked out of his own tomb. He established a church. So I'm going to go with him and put a little asterisk next to this thing I don't understand. And you could do the same thing if Pope Francis says something that I don't quite understand what's going on here. Because if you have that rigid mentality to warn someone, hey, look, you're going to be out the door. You're not just going to give up the Pope. If you say, hey, apparent contradiction, this doesn't work, you're going to leave Christianity. You couldn't even believe in God because you'll say, hey, God's all good. There's evil. Apparent contradiction. I don't know how to resolve it. If you have this rigid mentality where if there's an apparent contradiction, I'm out the door, you're going to be an atheistic nihilist. So I think what you said is very good, that you can say, you can present possible options, but it's fine to be humble and say, I'm not sure, but I have all this other evidence, you know, whether it's a Bible contradiction or a contradiction in magisterial texts. I know there's a God. There has to be a God that created everything. I know that Jesus's resurrection is the only thing that makes sense of why Christianity got started in the first place. And the Catholic Church is the only thing that makes sense of how Christianity grew in the first 300 years and onward. And then from there, you've got your anchor and you've got these apparent contradictions, at least a bit. It shouldn't give you as much worry.
Right. Exactly. Okay. Now I want to talk a little bit about some of your personal experiences. People would like to hear us about, you've been involved in a lot of debates, a lot of different discussions. What would you say is probably your favorite debate that you've ever been involved in yourself?
Yeah, so I think my favorite debate was my debate with Ben Watkins last year. This is back in August in Houston at the Capturing Christianity Conference. This is a neat event, and this is actually a neat way to talk about ecumenism. So that event was a Protestant conference, though it was focused on mere Christianity. So it was focused on defending the existence of God, the resurrection. And there was a Protestant who was supposed to debate a well-known atheistic speaker, but both of them had to drop out for personal reasons and COVID. So they got a new atheist and they said, hey, Trent, you do really good debates. Why don't you come and debate him? So I debated him, Ben Watkins, Real Atheology. He was really the first debate opponent I felt who took me seriously, rigorously studied what I had to say. So the debate was very neck and neck, even. I still think I came out ahead, but he was very well prepared. So it made for a very stimulating and intellectually enriching discussion. And he's a gentleman. We could debate and not and be have ideas clash without being jerks or anything like that. And so I liked that. And I thought it really benefited the audience to see this engagement with high level Catholic philosophy promoting the existence of God and high level atheism. It's not like Richard Dawkins stuff. It's like really higher level stuff. And so that is good for atheists to leave the village atheism stuff to come over to more philosophy. So yeah, that one was probably one of my favorites. And what's helpful here, Eric, like when we talk about ecumenism, one of the reasons that I have focused on, I do a lot of apologetics, but I focus a lot on atheism, pro-life, the resurrection. I've done a debate on the resurrection. I want to put out the best resources on those questions so that any Christian, Catholic or non-Catholic, will go to them. Because I know a lot of Protestants who read my work because they like how I handle atheism. And that warms them up to my arguments for Catholicism. And so you serve ecumenism in that respect. And frankly, I've been kind of disappointed a little with in the Catholic apologetic world that like Protestants really have a good lock on like defending mere Christianity. And we don't have as many people who do that. I'd love to train more and see more people out there. But in doing that, that's another reason I like that debate, was because after it, I got to hang out with Protestants all weekend, and some of them had bought Case for Catholicism, and I signed it, and we talked, and so that was like a real authentic ecumenical outreach, you know?
You're doing like apologetics for against atheism, but doing backdoor apologetics towards the Protestant.
Right, and also here's what was fun about that. What was really fun was it's not just I regurgitated Protestant arguments, but I offered Catholic philosophy to address particular objections. So it's unique. So for example, we had a panel discussion and it was so fun to be at this conference. I want to go to more of them because you go to Catholic conferences, you know, it's all the same.
Right.
But a Protestant conference, you just get so many different kinds of people. So we had a panel of all the speakers and they asked us, how many of you believe in classical theism? Like how many of you think God is timeless? And like only I and one other guy raised our hands. And so everyone else, you know, believe God is temporal. He's in time. They reject what divine, I think everyone else on the panel, I think, rejected divine simplicity, except for maybe one other person.
Wow.
But it became an opportunity to discuss, well, here's why I think this robust view of God can really tackle atheism better than less robust views. And then to share with them, here's why I think all these Catholic arguments together, the whole Catholic worldview has a lot to offer.
Okay, now I'm going to put you on the spot, and you got to be honest here. Have you ever felt like you lost a debate, or at least you felt like your opponent was really good and to the point where he might have kind of topped you in it? I know it's not about winning or losing, but you know what I mean.
Sure. Well, I think in any debate, I've used this analogy before, that it's sort of like boxing matches when you do a debate. Some debates I've done, it's like full knockout. It's not even fair.
Right.
And when you're engaging the other person, you can tell by their countenance that they didn't feel like they did very well. It's just a knockout. Other debates, though, you land good punches and the other guy lands good punches, too. And you can watch the debate and look at it in different ways. So I think like overall, for example, I did well in my debate against James White on whether a Christian can lose his salvation. But I did not think that there were areas where if I go back now, I would have handled cross-examination a lot differently, because I think James got a few good blows in on me. So there, if you were to judge that debate, it would not be I knocked out James White. It might be I won by technical knockout by just adding up the points. So I think there have been some where it's definitely a lot closer. The other person was had definitely a lot more rebuttals and things to offer, and others where it was further apart. And there have just been some debates where my opponent said something and I wasn't sure what they referred to. And if I could go back and say, oh, I would handle it. Oh, here's what I would say. Like when I was debating Alex O'Connor on atheism, we were debating quantum physics and he was referencing something in quantum physics. And I gave more of a generic response. And then after the debate, I thought about it. I thought, oh, he's talking about spooky action at a distance. Oh, I would have had a much better response if I had clicked that in my head. But it's like any sporting man, it's like anything. You go back, hindsight's 20/20. But overall, I think that those engagements, whether they're debate or dialogue, which I prefer if someone is a good dialogue partner, overall, I think help people come to see more about the faith.
What would you say is probably the toughest question you've ever had to face where you really thought this, like it's the most challenging one to answer, to defend as a Catholic?
Yeah, I don't know. to be honest, the toughest questions that I get asked are just the ones that have a simple yet unsatisfying answer, I would say. So the toughest questions might be related to the problem of evil to someone who is personally struggling with evil and suffering, especially if they ask you in a public forum what your response is going to be. Because the answer is a simple one about God's infinity, his ability to bring good from evil, or, you know, a simple three-step summary of the answer to the problem of evil. But it's just very unsatisfying to someone who's really in the midst of the emotional problem of evil. Or I get asked, you know, how do I help my son come back to the church? It's like, I don't know. I don't know him. I can help with an argument or something he's struggling with, but I don't know how to penetrate deep into the soul of where this person is. So I think those can be difficult. It's interesting you asked me this, though, because I've just sent to Catholic Answers Press a new book I'm working on. I finished it. And it's a dialogue between me and my inner skeptic. So it's a dialogue book between the voice of doubt in my own head. And so I cover those different tough questions where I'm not really sure how to answer that. And I'm not really, that is kind of a tough question. And I cover things like tough questions related to hell. Like, why would God make someone knowing they're going to go to hell? And, you know, that's a tough one right there.
Right.
I don't have a clean answer to that question. At best, I can say, well, the balance of evidence still shows Catholicism is true. And I think there are some things related to that issue that can help me make sense of it, even if they're not a complete answer. And then I just have to accept, like what St. Paul said, on this side of the veil, we see as in a mirror dimly. And what he meant, though, a lot of people don't understand that, is during his time, a mirror was just polished bronze, wasn't glass. Well, they had primitive glass in Egypt, but it was polished bronze. You look in polished metal, you kind of see yourself. And that's with some of these tough questions. That's the best we're going to get at this side of the veil. And then the other side will get the full answer.
Right. And I think that's probably it goes back to what you're saying near the beginning of bad apologetics. It's people who don't want to recognize that the mirror isn't always clear when they answer questions. That sometimes the answer is not satisfying. It's not necessary. Like I was saying before, you can't always reconcile it perfectly.
Right.
But you just say, okay, we're soldier on, because a lot of other things we can't answer very well.
Yeah.
One thing I wanted to ask was, who would you say is maybe one or two of the best non-Catholic apologists out there?
Yeah. So there are a few that I really enjoy for different reasons. The non-Catholic apologists. Well, that's interesting the way that you've phrased it, actually. So here, let's go through this. So there are Protestant apologists who defend mere Christianity. And ones that I recommend, I like William Lane Craig for his preparation, his extensive knowledge of issues, his professionalism in doing debates and being always very prepared and being extensively versed in the issues. That it's not good if you try to do apologetics and you only have a surface level knowledge of the issue. You're going to get in trouble pretty quickly there. My friend Randall Rouser is a Protestant theologian. He might be more left on certain issues, but he calls himself the tentative apologist. He's very good at not overstating the case and being honest about things. So I like that. And you find something similar with Josh Rasmussen, who is a Protestant who deals with the existence of God. I have really enjoyed his work. He's very congenial, very gentle. Mike Lacona has a similar temperament. He's a great defender of the resurrection in the Protestant world who defend mere Christianity. Now, there are Protestants who defend Protestantism. Ones that I've really enjoyed are those who are knowledgeable and charitable. So there are Protestants. There are Protestant apologists who are neither knowledgeable nor charitable. They're the worst. There are some that are charitable, but they're just pushovers. They don't really know anything. And then there are those that are knowledgeable and lack charity, and I just don't enjoy them very much. Right. You know, but there are those who are knowledgeable and I would say quite charitable. Jordan Cooper is a Lutheran I really like. Gavin Ortlund is a Baptist who I've done rebuttal videos with him. I'm hoping to set up a debate with him maybe late spring, early summer, but we've engaged each other's work. But then there's apologists for other non-Christian sects, if you think about it. So like when it comes to atheism, the best people out there, apologists is a loose label. Philosophers like Graham Oppie, probably one of the best. the real atheology crew, the Ben Watkins I debated and others, they're good. I had this agnostic Joe Schmidt, who's like 21, and he makes me feel like an old guy because he already knows so much. So I get a taste of what other people felt like, I guess, when I was like 21. Right. Now I'm like, all right, great. And then there are others and other non-Christian religions, like among Muslims, there are many Muslim apologists I really don't enjoy. I think they lack charity. An exception to that would be Shabir Ali. I think he is a very charitable Muslim apologist and knowledgeable. So there's a few off the top of my head. When you do apologetics, it's good to be versed in the apologists of other sects, S-E-C-T-S, to be aware of the good arguments that are out there.
Right. And that's just the St. Thomas way. You're not trying to find something to knock down, just the easiest thing, a straw man, but you're trying to find the best arguments and engage with those. Okay, I think we're running out of time here. Why don't you tell us where people can find out more about all, I mean, you're doing a ton of stuff, so where's the best way they can find out all the different things you're doing?
Well, I'd recommend people check out my podcast, The Council of Trent, C-O-U-N-S-E-L, and you can find that on iTunes, Google Play. It also has a YouTube channel, so it's The Council of Trent. You can just subscribe to it. YouTube's an easy place to go, or iTunes, Google Play. And you can support that podcast also at trenthornpodcast.com. So that's a good way to keep following what I'm doing. My books are available wherever you can get online, you know, Catholic books available. And I publish a lot at catholic.com. But I think my podcast is a good place for people to follow up with me.
You lucked out with your name, getting that purple. Yes. Council
of Pretty Trent. Good for having non-Catholic parents at all.
Yeah, there you go. Exactly. Together,
yeah.
Little did they know what that would lead to one day. I will link to all this. I'll link to your podcast and to your homepage and Catholic Answers so people can find out more about the stuff you're doing. Hey, I really appreciate you coming on the program, Trent. This has been great.
Anytime, Eric.
Okay, everybody else, until next time, God love you.